light pause. That's the problem with MRI. It can show us way too much. I was increasingly frustrated and desperate for a solution, but leery of the idea of undergoing 3 operations. My wife, Pam, also a physician, said she was worried that my judgment might be impaired by the long siege of pain and debility. So she came along to my next appointment. I had to pull strings to see Dr. C., one of the most renowned hand surgeons in the United States. He was the kind of doctor whose name routinely comes to the lips of other physicians and who is listed every year in his city's magazine under "The Best Doctors in..." His waiting room was packed like Dr. A.'s, but instead of the artwork that typically adorned physicians' offices, photographs of sailboats or paintings of meadows, the walls of Dr. C.'s clinic were filled with plaques. Hardly a space was left uncovered. I read a few of the plaques, each attested to Dr. C.'s fame. One was from the International Conference on Abnormalities of the Thumb, held in Rio de Janeiro. Another was on the repair of the rheumatoid finger, held in St. Moritz, Switzerland, during the height of the ski season. Framed conference programs were mounted next to the plaques, and Dr. C. was a prominently featured speaker on each. I was greeted first by a resident in orthopedic surgery. In his mid-20s, with a boyish smile and Brooks Brothers attire, the resident took my history and looked at my X-rays and MRI as he prepared to present my case to Dr. C. Dr. C. entered the room. He nodded hello to Pam and me. Standing before me, he took my right hand in his and began to examine it while simultaneously listening to the resident recite my clinical history. "Where are the X-rays?" he asked. The resident handed them to him, and without a word, Dr. C. darted from the room with the resident in tow. He moved so quickly he could have been on roller skates. Not more than 5 minutes later, Dr. C. returned. "We need to do an arthroscopy," he said. This meant inserting an instrument like a flexible telescope into my wrist in order to see the actual bones and ligaments. "I'll have the resident schedule it." Dr. C. turned to leave. "I realize you are in a rush," I ventured. "Rush? Why do you think I'm in a rush?" Dr. C. shot back. "Well, I wonder if you could tell me what you expect to find with the arthroscopy." "I'll figure it out when I get in there," he said, and left the room. The resident sat down and took out the sheet of paper that I was to sign to authorize the arthroscopy. Pam had been quiet, communicating through glances with me. As I read the paper, she began to question the resident, politely but pointedly. She wanted to know how long the procedure took, what the likelihood of each complication was, not just a list of possible complications, and how long it took to recover. Pam tells her patients that no intervention in medicine is completely innocuous or without risk. The resident answered her in a tense voice, unaccustomed to being the primary interlocutor in place of Dr. C. The procedure would take about 20 minutes, not counting the preparation with anesthesia that involved numbing the nerves to the arm. Pain and swelling were the main complications, infection being rare. A full recovery would take about 2 to 3 weeks. I did not sign the paper. I felt dazed. I had called in numerous favors to get to Dr. C., and he had flown by without pausing to share any of his reputed brilliance. Pam continued to query the resident. "If Dr. C. decided the cysts in the bones accounted for the pain and swelling, what kind of grafts would he insert?" "No, we don't do bone grafts here," the resident said. "Here we fuse the bones." Pam and I looked at each other knowingly. We had both trained at the Massachusetts General Hospital, where, at times in a complex situation, the rationale given trainees for choosing one therapy over another was that an eminent MGH physician did it that way. It was received wisdom, handed down as if from the heavens. When we left Boston and went to the University of California at Los Angeles, we found another kind of received wisdom. Again, a distinguished physician on the UCLA staff had his personal approach to the same complex clinical problem. But, to our surprise, it could be very different from the one at the MGH. Nevertheless, the UCLA strategy was spoken of just as reverently, as if it too had descended from celestial heights. "I really would like to hear what Dr. C. thinks is going on," I said to the resident. "I don't know if he realizes that we are both doctors." The resident said that he would try to bring Dr. C. back to the room. 20 minutes later, Dr. C. returned. "Nice to meet you," he said, not exactly calmly, but not at the Gatling gun pace of the earlier visit. Dr. C. began to list the names of doctors he knew who might have crossed paths with me during my career in Boston and Los Angeles. It turned out, not unexpectedly, that we knew several in common. Pam asked what he thought was the leading diagnosis. "Chondrocalcinosis," Dr. C. replied. "Chondrocalcinosis is also called pseudo-gout. Calcium crystals form deposits in the cartilage, making the normally pliable tissue stiff and inflamed. The crystals also float in the fluid of the joint space." "Wouldn't you see the calcium deposits on the X-rays?" Pam asked. "There are cases where the X-rays are negative," Dr. C. replied. "And the bone cysts?" Dr. C. said again that he would figure them out during the arthroscopy. Dr. C. started to fidget in his chair and then took my left hand and grasped it as a sign of concluding the contact. "My resident will set up the procedure. Don't worry." But I was worried. Pam was worried. And both of us were disheartened. We had come with great expectations, and everything about Dr. C. deflated them. Many years before, when I had serious back pain from a sports injury, the surgeons said they would explore my spine and figure it out. Out of frustration, I had impulsively opted for the procedure. They ended up fusing the vertebrae. It left me debilitated. In hindsight, I blamed myself more than the surgeons. I had pressed them for a solution when, in fact, none was apparent because the cause of the pain was obscure. That catastrophe had chastened me. It felt like déjà vu with Dr. C. But Dr. C. was world-renowned, the featured speaker at international conferences. So I went to a standard medical textbook and reviewed the chapter on chondrocalcinosis. Nothing in any of my prior tests suggested chondrocalcinosis. If the X-rays don't show the calcium deposits, the easiest way to find the crystals is to withdraw some fluid from the joint with a small needle, not by performing an arthroscopy. And treatment of chondrocalcinosis involved anti-inflammatory drugs like naproxen or steroid injections into the joint, both of which I had already tried, to no effect. Dr. Light echoed these thoughts. Chondrocalcinosis made no sense. If you think someone has chondrocalcinosis, they don't need arthroscopy. They need a strong anti-inflammatory medication like indomethacin. Dr. C. had offered a diagnosis that, while not invented, like Dr. A.'s hyperreactive synovium, was nevertheless inventive. I decided to do nothing. Nearly a year passed. I did not use my right hand much. Instead of writing, I switched to using a dictating machine. I avoided the computer entirely. Occasionally, something trivial, like swimming a few extra laps, followed by writing 3 or 4 checks to pay bills, would cause a flare-up. My hand would turn red, swell, and become excruciatingly painful. I would apply ice, support it with a splint, and after a few days, the inflammation would subside. A new young hand surgeon, whom I will call Dr. D, came to Boston, and the word among the senior staff was that he was a hotshot. I was curious and scheduled an appointment with him. Dr. D had a warm, affable manner and listened intently as I recounted the sequence of traumatic events to the hand and the episodic flare-ups. He surprised me by examining not only my right hand but also my left, and then he said that he wanted x-rays of both hands, not only when they were stationary, but when I flexed them as if gripping something tightly. This was the first time anyone had ever paid attention to the left wrist or tried to picture the bones of my hands during a maneuver. "As I suspected," Dr. D said, without a whiff of arrogance in his tone. He put the x-rays on a light box and showed me how the space between the scaphoid and lunate bones widened when my right hand was in a gripping position. The left hand showed no widening of the joint. I think the ligament between the scaphoid and lunate is partly torn, or at least not functioning well, he said. The reason I had pain with even minor stress on my right hand was that the lax or torn ligament caused friction between the bones. He went on to explain that there also could be channels from the cysts into the joint, so that they functioned like lakes with thin canals. As the fluid in the cysts came under pressure, the liquid would be squeezed out through the canals into the joint. This set off the inflammation. Dr. D's scenario made sense to me, but the MRI had shown neither problems with the ligament nor channels from the cysts. Dr. D replied that despite the MRI, he would bet the ligament was abnormal and that connections existed between the cysts and the joints. Doctors relied too much on such sophisticated scans, he continued, so sometimes you had to discount their findings if they were out of sync with the clinical picture. Filling the cysts with bone grafts would probably not do much good in the long run without repairing the ligament, because the loose joint would continue to generate friction, causing pain. Dr. D proposed taking bone grafts from my hip, filling in the cysts, and repairing the ligament. As to the other abnormalities on the MRI scan that Dr. B wanted to fix, the tendon to the pinky and the tiny cyst in the other bone, Dr. D was reluctant to operate on them. He said the wear and tear on the hands of a man in his 50s who banged on a computer and played sports and was something of a klutz in elevators could cause such findings on an MRI, but trying to fix them might do more harm than good. Dr. D seemed sober and independent in his thinking, not bowing to technology when it clashed with a patient's history and physical exam. But was he right? I decided to assume for a moment that he was, and I asked him how many times he had performed the kind of operation he was proposing. He paused and said, "Once." Then he elaborated, saying that he had done it several times with supervision, but only a single time by himself. He was just at the beginning of his career. "That's the struggle when patients are having pain," Dr. Light said after hearing Dr. D's thoughts and contrasting them with Dr. B's. "You can see many things on an MRI, but nothing that's clearly responsible for the symptoms. So you begin to go around and around. The hateful part of MRIs, I mean they can be a wonderful technology, but they find abnormalities in everybody. More often than not, I am stuck trying to figure out whether the MRI abnormality is responsible for the pain. That is the really hard part." "The key," Dr. Light continued, "is for everything to add up. The patient's symptoms, the findings on physical examination, what appears meaningful on the MRI or other x-rays. It has to come together and form a coherent picture." In effect, he was describing pattern recognition, and saying that if a clear pattern is not apparent, the surgeon is in a quandary. Picking up a scalpel and cutting can be just the wrong thing. This, though, was what doctors A, B, and C without recognizing a coherent and consistent pattern, were set to do. I have made the diagnosis Dr. D made, of dynamic scaphoid lunate instability, Light told me, affixing the technical term to the problem of a lax ligament that causes the bones to shift out of alignment. The patient usually comes in with a stack of X-rays like you did. And then I tell him that I want to get a grip view, an X-ray when he is crunching his hand. And he says, "But you guys have taken every possible X-ray already." Then you look at the joint space between the scaphoid and lunate bones, and you can drive a truck through it. The point is, you have to think of it. Why did it take 3 years to think of it? Light said that no one had ever really taught him how to think of it. Instead, he learned to observe senior surgeons closely, often one-on-one in the OR, and then began to imitate those who worked with clarity and effectiveness. He also observed surgeons who did not seem especially clear in their judgments or effective in the OR. He tried to figure out what made the difference. It is still very much an art, a guild, where you are an apprentice and work with a master craftsman, he said. Light added that although the conventional wisdom states that surgeons must have great hands, that successful surgery requires manual dexterity, in fact, it is more about deft decision-making. Of course, if you are a total klutz, you have a problem in the OR, Light allowed, and having good eye-hand coordination is helpful. But Light referred to an article titled Less Than 10 by Dr. Paul Brown, an ex-military surgeon practicing in Hartford, Connecticut. Brown reported on surgeons who themselves suffered injuries to their hands, like losing part of or an entire finger. Of course, there are certain very technically demanding procedures, like sewing together a small blood vessel, that require exquisite dexterity, Light said. But short of this, as Brown's article showed, there is a surprising degree of latitude. Most surgeons learn dexterity through repeated practice. Where they differ most, Light said, is not in technique, the kind of stitch they prefer, or the particular instrument they like to use in a particular setting, but in how they conceptualize a patient's problem and understand what surgery can and cannot do to remedy it. The surgeon's brain is more important than his hands. Terry Light trained at Yale New Haven Hospital, and during his internship worked closely with Dr. Richard Seltzer, renowned not only as a surgeon, but also as a writer. Seltzer showed the young Terry Light that a surgeon has to have a high level of confidence to operate, or, as Seltzer had written, the audacity to take a knife to another human being. A certain bravado goes with being a surgeon, Light admitted. I told Light that I had begun to learn about the types of cognitive shortcuts we use as doctors, and how at times that certain bravado affects cognition. Together, Light and I assessed the pitfalls in the thinking of the hand surgeons I had consulted. Dr. A showed what is called commission bias. This is the tendency toward action rather than inaction. Such an error is more likely to happen with a doctor who is overconfident, whose ego is inflated, but it can also occur when a physician is desperate and gives in to the urge to do something. The error, not infrequently, is sparked by pressure from a patient, and it takes considerable effort for a doctor to resist. "Don't just do something, stand there," Dr. Linda Lewis, one of my mentors, once said when I was unsure of a diagnosis. This was one of the rare instances, I told Terry Light, when a senior physician had explicitly cautioned me about what can be categorized as a cognitive mistake. It was a firm, no-nonsense injunction from Dr. Lewis, culled from her decades of clinical experience, handed down as master craftswoman to apprentice. Lewis explained that inaction is not at all what is expected from a physician, nor what a physician expects from himself. But sometimes it is the best course. Dr. B made a different cognitive error. called satisfaction of search by some and search satisficing by others. This is the tendency to stop searching for a diagnosis once you find something. It has an analogy in everyday life. Say you are getting ready to leave the house for work and time is short to catch your train. Perhaps you were out late the night before, or had a little too much wine at dinner, or had an argument with your teenager, and all of this is on your mind. You look for your wallet, and it's not on your desk where you usually leave it. You look some more and find it on the night table. You feel relieved that you found your wallet and put it in your pocket. Now you'll make the train. Back to a doctor trying to solve a patient's problem. The patient has a symptom that the doctor needs to explain. As he searches for the explanation, the doctor finds something wrong in the physical examination or a lab test or an X-ray. This is what happened when Dr. B jumped on the bone cysts in the MRI scan, the equivalent of locating the wallet on the night table. The problem is that there may be more than one thing to be found. Dr. Pat Crosscarry put it this way: finding something may be satisfactory, but not finding everything is suboptimal. After putting your wallet in your pocket, walking out of your house, closing the door, and approaching your car to drive to the train, you realize that you're missing your keychain. Now you not only lack the car key, you have closed the front door and can't get back in without your house key. You were so pleased about finding your wallet that your mind shut down and you didn't consider what else was missing. Suboptimal indeed. Dr. D was able to avoid this type of error by asking himself whether there was more to be found beyond what was seen on the plain X-rays and MRI scans. He kept searching because he was not satisfied that what he had before him was enough to account for all of my symptoms. To get me to where I needed to go, he had to find not only the wallet, but the keys. Dr. D avoided another error in thinking called vertical line failure, more commonly known as thinking inside the box. Although thinking outside the box has become a hackneyed phrase, it still embodies the truth that sometimes lateral thinking that breaks out of the ordinary is vital. That box is the MRI scan, a revered technology that strongly constrains a doctor's thinking. Creativity and imagination, rather than adherence to the obvious, are needed in situations where the data and clinical findings do not all fit neatly together. Dr. Karen Delgado, the specialist in endocrinology and metabolism, is well recognized in her city for her lateral thinking, making diagnoses that require such creativity and imagination. When I asked her how she learned to think this way, she said she wasn't sure, but that when she was an intern, she liked to play a mind game. When she admitted a patient with what seemed to be a clear and obvious diagnosis, she would stop and ask herself, "What else could this be?" Sometimes she was unable to come up with any other diagnosis. The obvious was almost certainly the answer. But on occasion, she could rearrange the data in her mind to form another plausible picture, a different pattern that could also account for the patient's symptoms. If this proved to be the case, then she searched further. She was careful never to be satisfied from the outset. Often the search was fruitless, and the initial and obvious diagnosis was correct. But once in a while, her deviation from vertical thinking, her breakout from the box where everything seemed to fit neatly, was critical in disproving that initial diagnosis, or in finding that lightning had struck more than once, that the patient had multiple problems requiring multiple diagnoses. This goes against the time-honored principle of Occam's razor: go with a single cause if it appears to explain all the data. Dr. Light said that during an exploratory arthroscopy in the OR, before the actual surgery, one of the other surgeons might have discovered what Dr. D found in his office, that the ligament was not functioning, that the joint between the scaphoid and lunate bones was distorted. But, I pointed out, it doesn't inspire confidence when a doctor tells you, "I'll figure it out in the O.R." He agreed. Paradoxically, such confidence is bolstered, Light said, when a physician opens his mind to a patient and explains what he knows and what he doesn't know, what is firm about his findings and what is still unclear, which symptoms he can account for and which still demand explanation. Suppose Dr. C. had stated things this way and explained that in the O.R., he would be able to assess the dynamic function of my wrist, be able to evaluate which joints might be deranged, instead of saying, "Leave it up to me." He would at least have shown me he was open to solving the puzzle rather than just throwing out a diagnosis, chondrocalcinosis, that didn't fit. Similarly, if Dr. B. had explained, as Dr. Light did, that an MRI scan can overread a problem, showing changes in the hand that deviate from the normal, but nonetheless should not be taken at face value, he would have inspired greater confidence and perhaps tacked away from deciding that 3 operations were necessary. After several weeks of considering Dr. D's advice, and after getting a similar diagnosis from a hand surgeon who was a friend and member of my synagogue, I learned that a major orthopedic center in another city was beta-testing a new MRI that provided greater resolution of the bones, tendons, and ligaments in the hand. I was curious about the reach of the new technology and whether it might shed light on Dr. D's analysis. I went for the experimental scan. As Dr. D had predicted, the ligament between the scaphoid and lunate bones was frayed and lax. Moreover, tiny channels extended from the cysts. I inquired of friends at the orthopedic center and learned that a Dr. E., some 30 years the senior of Dr. D., had performed repairs of this type scores of times. I met with Dr. E. He was formal and focused in his speech, saying that the arthroscopy and the surgery would be performed at one sitting. In addition, he used a new form of synthetic bone material for grafts, making it unnecessary to cut into my hip to harvest bone chips. Overall, the surgery was a success. After 5 months of rehabilitation, my wrist was about 80% of normal, not 100%. Struggling with a can opener set off swelling and a deep ache. "You have arthritis in the joint," Dr. Reese said in his no-nonsense manner. "Just be careful. There are limits." This was another message that Dr. Light believes surgeons should communicate to their patients, especially in advance of an operation. "The perfect is the enemy of the good," Light said. "Nothing that you do in surgery is perfect. Everything is a compromise. 80% of normal after surgery? Well, that's pretty good," he said. Frankly, I had hoped for 100%, and like most patients, I expected to be restored to pristine condition. More often than not, that is unrealistic. While you cannot predict a specific outcome for any particular patient, Light emphasized, you need to be candid and not paint too rosy a scenario. This requires an uncommon degree of honesty. Uncommon because it demands a certain deflation of the physician's ego. Here we have the contrast between what Seltzer wrote about, the healthy ego necessary to putting a knife to another human being's flesh, a belief in one's own ability to make the right judgments in the OR and to work with dispatch, and the ego that imagines the scalpel as a magic wand that can restore a diseased body part perfectly. Such honesty is not rewarded in today's society. Patients shop for doctors. Some doctors are keen to market themselves, knowing that it's easier to make the sale if they present their work as top of the line, like a luxury automobile that flawlessly navigates the toughest curves and shifts gears seamlessly. But my banged-up hand was a 1952 Studebaker, and only so much could be done in the shop. It would never emerge as a brand new Lexus. One of the intriguing things about hand surgery, Dr. Light said, is that every patient comes in with his story. And you decode that story, and then figure out not only what you can do for him, but what you can't. Early on in the life of a surgeon, the technical component is very important. When you are a resident in training, you say to yourself, I just did my first total hip replacement, skin to skin, and I feel great. Oh my gosh, what a sense of accomplishment. I remember the first time I reattached a finger, and I saw it pink up, and it was wondrous. As you get older, the sense of accomplishment becomes the patient who returns and tells you how much better he can function now. It's not the surgery per se, but the person who is happy and pleased. So you don't want to leave people disappointed. To do that, you have to clarify the expectations up front. And then you have some people come in and demand a certain procedure, and you know in your heart that they are not going to be satisfied, although it might be fine for someone else. Dr. Light was revealing the kind of thinking that the most seasoned and expert doctors display. They think in sync with the patient. The patient should be helped to think in sync with the doctors, too. In the case of my problem hand, did it all turn out pretty well because I am a doctor? Of course, I am at a great advantage being a physician and being married to one. But much of this 3-year odyssey was guided by my having suffered earlier from a failed operation on my spine. Yes, my technical knowledge helped, but common sense was key. There is nothing in biology or medicine that is so complicated that, if explained in clear and simple language, cannot be understood by any layperson. It's not quantum physics, Dr. Linda Lewis, my mentor at Columbia, once said on rounds. There was an easily understood set of explanations for what was wrong with my hand. The cysts developed because of trauma. The wear and tear on the scaphoid and lunate bones, from the banging on the computer, the karate chop in the swimming pool, the slamming elevator door. All this resulted in a breakdown of the matrix in these bones, and they filled with viscous fluid. The ligament probably was further damaged along the way by the extreme force I exerted while struggling with the juice bottle. Invented answers like hyperreactive synovium sound scientific and might initially impress a layman. Latin and Greek terms make up much of medical jargon and can take on unwarranted authority. But a layman speaking with another specialist, or checking in a medical textbook or on one of the better internet sites, would soon discover that hyperreactive synovium is a unicorn, a mythical beast. Dr. B was well-intentioned, but not conservative enough. Sometimes less is more, and more can be too much. The compulsion to do everything, to address every abnormality, even when those abnormalities are not particularly bothersome, reveals an irrationally idealized approach to practicing medicine. As Terry Light said, the perfect can be the enemy of the good. Patients can help the doctor think by asking questions. If he mentions a possible complication from surgery, they can ask how often it happens. If he talks about pain and lingering discomfort from a procedure, they can ask how the pain compares with having a tooth pulled under Novocaine, or some other unpleasant event. If he recommends a procedure, patients can ask why, what might be found, with what probability, and importantly, how much difference it will make to find it. Some physicians will be uneasy, some even angry when queried this way, because they may not have all the answers. Others will take the time and clearly respond to these simple, direct, reasonable questions. The kind of response illuminates how much the doctor really knows about your case and how much still needs to be discovered. Dr. D is a hero here. Not only did he think, and think independently, figuring out the genesis of my unusual problem, but he challenged today's high-tech god, the MRI scan. He was totally honest about his track record. He could have brushed aside my question and said something like, "I've done the operation successfully," which would have been true, in a single case. Terry Light had no doubt that with each passing year, Dr. D will only get better, because a searching mind guides his hands. Chapter 8. The Eye of the Beholder. Primary care physicians regularly look to doctors like Dennis Orwig to confirm the health of certain patients and identify disease in others. But despite his importance in the diagnosis and treatment of patients, very few ever meet him. In fact, Dr. Orwig spends most of his day alone, sitting in the dark. If there were a window in his office, he would look out on some of the most stunning landscape in the United States. Marin General Hospital, north of San Francisco, where Orwig works, has a commanding view of Mount Tamalpais, the undulating rise named by the Miwok Indians for its resemblance to a sleeping maiden. Eucalyptus trees surround the hospital, and soft breezes filter through their branches. But Orwig is purposely cloistered from these surroundings because he is a radiologist. Nothing should distract him from the three monitors at his workstation. On a typical day, he reads the digital images projected on the monitors, chest X-rays that show the heart, lungs, ribs, and clavicles, mammograms that unmask growths, some benign, others malignant, CT and MRI scans that reveal the architecture of organs, blood vessels, and bones. Radiology is a discipline broken down into two processes, the process of perception and the process of cognition, he said. This means that first, a radiologist must make an observation. Second, he needs to analyze what he perceived, what it means, the possible explanations for the finding. This dual process is repeated second by second, minute by minute, hour after hour during his working day. Like primary care physicians, he risks missing something significant in the blur, a change in contour of a tissue, or a variation in density of an organ that he needs to notice. And, as with Dr. Victoria McAvoy and others, the sheer volume has become daunting. A decade ago, a radiologist like Orwig in private practice might evaluate from 12 to 15,000 cases a year. By one estimate, the workload currently reaches from 16 to 25,000 cases. Some cases generate only a few images, but others involve hundreds or thousands. For example, a patient in the emergency room with fever and a cough may have a chest X-ray. This study is done with the individual in two positions, one with the chest pressed against the plate, and the second with the chest pressed at the side. Thus, there are two images that a radiologist examines in this case. But a CT scan of the abdomen, which is often ordered in the ER when there is a suspicion of appendicitis, generates many hundreds of images, and the radiologist has to select the key ones to analyze from this multitude. For that reason, radiologists are expected to look at and analyze images very quickly. In fact, conclusions from first impressions, or gestalt, are supposed to be the mark of good training, much as shooting from the hip is prized among ER doctors. But Orwig takes issue with this celebrated form of thinking. "I was trained at the University of California, San Francisco," Orwig told me. "It is ranked as one of the top programs in the country. But I believe there was a deficiency in the training, and I know from colleagues that the flaw was not only there, but at many other centers. As novices, they were taught to systematically inspect each anatomic component on the X-ray. But the aim was to develop sufficient expertise so that they could abandon the deliberate deconstruction of pictures and see at a glance what is abnormal. Somehow, over time, you were supposed to get it when looking at an image. The stated reason for fostering this mode of perception and cognition was that it fit with the large number of images that a radiologist would view each working day. And, indeed, many doctors in this specialty rely heavily on first impression, gestalt, rapidly distinguishing normal from abnormal, drawing conclusions within seconds of viewing an image. But Orwig soon realized that while this often succeeded, many radiologists, including seasoned ones, missed important findings. His concern about gestalt comes not only from his own experience in practice, but from studies in the medical literature. Dr. E. James Potchen at Michigan State University in East Lansing has studied performance in reading chest X-rays. More than 100 certified radiologists were assessed. These studies at Michigan State used a series of 60 chest X-rays that included duplicates of some of the films. When the radiologists were asked, "Is the film normal?" they disagreed among themselves an average of 20% of the time. This is called inter-observer variability. When a single radiologist reread on a later day the same 60 films, he contradicted his earlier analysis from 5 to 10% of the time. This is called intra-observer variability. One film of the 60 was of a patient who was missing his left clavicle. Presenting such a chest X-ray was meant to assess performance in noticing what was not on the film rather than merely searching for a positive finding. An exercise that points out our natural preference for focusing on positive data and ignoring the negative, as James Locke emphasized. Remarkably, 60% of the radiologists failed to identify the missing clavicle. When clinical data were added to the exercise, informing the radiologist that the 60 chest X-rays were obtained as part of an annual physical examination, which primary care doctors perform in order to screen for serious diseases like lung cancer, 58% of the radiologists still missed it and scored the film as normal. However, when they were told that the chest X-rays were obtained as part of a series of studies to find a cancer, then 83% of the radiologists identified the missing bone. This highlighted that a specific clinical cue can substantially improve performance, because the radiologist is systematically searching with attention to a particular condition, rather than relying on a flash impression. One of the most interesting outcomes of Putchin's study using the 60 films was to compare the top 20 radiologists, who had a diagnostic accuracy of nearly 95%, with the bottom 20, who had a diagnostic accuracy of 75%. Most worrisome was the level of confidence each group had in its analysis. The radiologists who performed poorly were not only inaccurate, they were also very confident that they were right when they were in fact wrong. Observers' lack of ability to discriminate normal from abnormal films does not necessarily diminish their confidence, Potchen wrote. His study also measured the time it took to read a set of films as an indication of the observer's decisiveness. All observers have characteristic ways in which they manage the threshold of uncertainty in making decisions. Some people are risk-takers, and they are likely to have more false positive errors. This means that they overread the images, calling a normal finding abnormal, a false positive. Others are risk-averse, and they are more likely to have high false negative rates. This means that their excess caution causes them to classify as normal what is actually diseased, a false negative. Still others cannot make up their minds, and they will have high ambiguity numbers and more frequently require additional films before reaching conclusions. Ironically, Potchen pointed out, based on his studies of radiologists, if you look at a film too long, you increase the risk of hurting the patient. After about 38 seconds, he found, many radiologists begin to see things that are not there. In essence, they generate false positives and begin to designate normal structures as abnormal. Potchen believes that this reflects their level of insecurity about what they are observing. As we have seen in the studies of Roter and Hall, and the writings of Cross-Carry, temperament can have a significant impact on diagnostic accuracy, even among doctors like radiologists who are not in direct contact with the patient. There is ample precedent for both significant intra-observer and inter-observer variability beyond the diagnosis of lung cancer. For example, interpretation of chest X-rays used for screening for tuberculosis showed inter-observer variability of about 33% and intra-observer variability of about 20%. In screening mammography, a sample of 110 radiologists who interpreted the mammograms of 148 women, the fraction of patients actually having cancer who were correctly diagnosed varied from 59 to 100%, and the fraction of patients without disease who were correctly diagnosed as normal ranged from 35 to 98%. Overall, the accuracy rate varied from 73 to 97%. Ehsan Sameh of the Advanced Imaging Laboratories at Duke University Medical Center recently summarized results from a variety of radiological procedures. Currently, the average diagnostic error in interpreting medical images is in the 20% to 30% range. These errors, being either of the false negative or false positive type, have significant impact on patient care. The question then is, how can radiologists improve their performance? It is not only in radiology that observation and analysis can vary widely among doctors. David Eddy, the health policy professor at Duke, writes about the physical examination, specifically for cyanosis, the bluing of the face and fingers that indicates a low level of oxygen in the blood. A study of 22 doctors was performed to assess their ability to diagnose cyanosis in 20 patients, with the true diagnosis confirmed by direct measurement of oxygen levels. Only 53% of the physicians were definite in diagnosing cyanosis in subjects with extremely low blood oxygen, and 26% of the physicians said cyanosis existed in subjects who had normal blood oxygen. Similarly, EKGs can be variously interpreted by physicians. One group of experts compiled 100 EKG readings, 50 of which showed myocardial infarction, heart attack, 25 of which were normal, and 25 of which showed some other abnormality. These EKGs were then given to 10 other cardiologists to test their diagnostic skills. The proportion of EKGs judged by the 10 fellow cardiologists to show a myocardial infarct varied by a factor of 2. If you had an infarct and went to physician A, there would be a 20% chance he would miss it. If you did not have an infarct and went to physician B, there would be a 26% chance that he would say you had one. Even among specialists examining a routine test, like an EKG, there can be widely divergent conclusions. Medical instruments do not necessarily yield definitive answers. Using a microscope, 13 pathologists read 1,001 specimens obtained from biopsies of the cervix and repeated the readings later. On average, each pathologist agreed with himself only 89% of the time, and with a panel of senior pathologists only 87% of the time. With the patients who actually had an abnormal cervix, the doctors who reconsidered their own earlier conclusions agreed with their first readings only 68% of the time. The senior pathologists concurred with their juniors in only 51% of the cases. While the pathologists generally did well on distinguishing clearly cancerous tissue from clearly normal tissue, they did less well in identifying precancerous lesions. Orwig has sought ways to avoid making errors by slowing his perception and analysis. He uses his dictated report as a mechanism to be systematic. The format of his dictation follows a highly structured checklist. For example, in reading a chest X-ray, he will explicitly comment not only on the lungs and heart, but also on the bones, the soft tissues of the chest and the mediastinum, the central structure of the thorax, as well as the pleura, the lining of the lungs. Only when he comes to the summary will he home in on the explicit clinical question that was posed by the internist or surgeon who requested the X-ray. Once I got a call from a clinician who said, "I ordered this X-ray to see if this man had pneumonia. Why did you put all the stuff in about his ribs?" Indeed, there was a large patch of white within the black image of the man's right lung, indicating a pneumonia. But Orwig had made special note in his dictated report of several healed rib fractures. Some radiologists would not take the breath to report these old fractures because they do not seem to be an active issue or relevant to the primary diagnosis, which is an infection, Orwig told me. Part of his rationale is just to be complete, but part is because any observation could prove to have clinical import. For example, old fractures might suggest that the patient had fallen in the past, because he is an alcoholic, or might have passed out due to a seizure disorder that was not recognized. People who are drunk or have a seizure sometimes aspirate their mucus, setting up a fertile field for bacteria to enter the lungs and trigger pneumonia. As it happened, the clinician went back and interviewed the man, who confessed that he was a binge drinker. The morning I spoke with Orwig, he had just returned home after a night on call. He had been asked to read a CT scan of a middle-aged man in the ICU. The patient was an alcoholic with liver disease and had been admitted to Marin General Hospital confused and delirious. It turned out that he was bleeding internally, and like many patients with cirrhosis, was tipped into his delirious state because his liver was unable to detoxify the products of digested blood from his gut. The CT scan was ordered because after initially improving, the patient had become delirious again. The ICU physician assumed that the man was once more bleeding internally. Orwig looked at the CT scan and then went through his methodical checklist. He traced every loop of bowel on an abdominal CT scan. His colleagues often joke when he lingers over the study, "There goes Dennis again, tracing every loop from the stomach to the anus." As he followed the turns of the intestines, he noticed what appeared to be small air bubbles in the abdomen. These bubbles did not look like the kind of gas we all have in our bowels. "I finally decided that the air bubbles couldn't be in the bowel," Orwig told me, "so they had to be in the superior mesenteric vein. Somehow, gas had accumulated in the vessels that drain blood from the intestines. Then I noticed that the loops of bowel near the gas bubbles were thickened." Orwig reasoned that the blood supply to the intestines must somehow be impaired. So there had been a breakdown in tissue, with gas from inside the bowel moving into the surrounding blood vessels. This condition is called ischemic bowel, meaning the bowel is starved of its nourishing blood supply and begins to decompose. When Orwig spoke with the clinician in the ICU, he was met with skepticism. "You guys aren't very good in diagnosing ischemic bowel," the physician said. Orwig agreed that it was a difficult diagnosis based on a CT scan, but explained that he had thoroughly traced every loop of intestine in the man's abdomen, and the gas didn't belong where he found it. It was imperative that a surgeon be called to assess the patient. If Orwig's presumption was correct, there was an urgency to operate and restore the blood supply to the bowel. Orwig was right, and the patient's life was saved. "Sometimes going with your gut just doesn't work in my field," Orwig quipped. "There is so much gas in the abdomen that just seeing a few little bubbles doesn't mean anything in the picture as a whole. It only has significance when you segregate out each structure, and then you can see that the gas doesn't belong there." As he systematically reviews every aspect of the film, Orwig explained, "My brain is forced to work in a similar stepwise way. It is easier, certainly quicker, to simply look at the pneumonia in the right lower lobe of the lung," he said, "and not take the time to detail all of the other information. But this protects me." Orwig is protected from the most common mistake that radiologists make. the error of search satisfaction. As we saw earlier, it is a natural cognitive tendency to stop searching, and therefore stop thinking, when one makes a major finding. This is all the more true in radiology, where a busy internist informs the radiologist that the patient has typical findings of fever, cough, and yellow sputum, and so directs the radiologist's attention on the lungs in his search for the expected pneumonia. But if he focuses solely on the lungs, Orwig said, and snaps to the correct diagnosis of pneumonia, he risks missing a dense area in an upper rib that suggests there may be an underlying cancer, or a widening in the mediastinum that could be an aneurysm of the aorta. Orwig is part of a large private radiology practice that consists of 11 doctors. They are conscious of the risk of making errors if overloaded, so recently they added 2 new members to the practice in order to limit the number of X-rays each one is required to read on a shift. Like primary care physicians, they are seeking new ways to secure enough time to think about each case. They also instituted a quality assurance program. Every day, each radiologist in Orwig's group reads 4 or 5 X-rays that are independently read by a colleague. Then the 2 readings are compared for discrepancies. Sometimes a discrepancy is insignificant. Other times it may be of major import. The results of this daily exercise are entered into a database for the entire group, so that there is ongoing monitoring of each radiologist as well as the whole team. This way we learn from each other's mistakes as well as our own, Orwig said. Orwig was chastened some time ago when one of his fellow radiologists came into the dark reading room with an MRI scan of a knee. "What do you think of this case?" his colleague asked. Orwig looked at the scan and said, "Torn ACL, anterior cruciate ligament, a common sports injury." The colleague put Orwig's report down in front of him. It read, "Normal anterior cruciate ligament." "I was mystified," Orwig told me. "It's incredible that at one time I could look at a film and only later see what I had missed." The only explanation that came to Orwig's mind was that he had relied too much on gestalt and not methodically traced every anatomic component in the knee. "This is also a problem of high volume," Orwig said. "A hematologist like you, Jerry, cares for patients over the course of months to years. You see them in follow-up visits, so when something goes wrong, you can deconstruct the steps in the diagnosis and treatment and figure out where you made mistakes. I am literally reading hundreds of X-rays day after day after day on different patients. Most of the X-rays are not follow-ups. So it is difficult for me to go back and figure out why I erred in my observation. I have no ability to put myself back in the seat when that knee case was in front of me." "Because of this," Orwig said, "I have to keep reminding myself to be systematic. The more experience you have, the more seasoned you are, the greater the temptation to rely on gestalt." E. James Putchin of Michigan State commented on Orwig's strategy of sticking to a methodical checklist. He agreed that Orwig would have some marginal gain by forcing himself to look at each of the anatomic structures on the film. But the real added value, Putchin said, was what Orwig did in drawing the clinician's attention to the rib fractures or gas bubbles. "Putchin has studied decision-making under uncertainty, not only in medicine, but also in law and in business." He recalled how Dr. Merrill Sossman, who was chief of radiology at the Brigham Hospital in Boston, would be given a chest X-ray and then declare to the residents in training, "This patient has kidney failure." This was a deduction worthy of Arthur Conan Doyle, and the residents would wonder, "How can you diagnose a problem with the kidneys by looking at the chest?" Sossman explained that he saw a thickening of the ribs, which led to the insight that there had been remodeling of the bones because the kidneys had failed, changing the metabolism of calcium and phosphate. "That's how you add value as a radiologist," Putchin said. you discover what is not known about the patient at the time that the X-ray was taken. And that's how you develop your cachet. You add something beyond what other people do. This, of course, is why primary care physicians are sending so many patients for radiological studies. Mammography is routinely ordered by primary care physicians as a screening test to detect early cancer in women entering middle age. Mammograms are the most monotonous type of work that we do, Orwig said. And mammograms are the most anxiety-provoking of all X-rays, he added. To miss a cancer is devastating, because the tumors that are found early are readily removed, and missing the cancer can result in metastases that are hard to control and rarely, if ever, cured. On the other hand, overreading a mammogram will subject a healthy woman to the emotional roller coaster of further imaging, a biopsy, and then the lingering doubt about whether there actually was a cancer that was missed despite the biopsy result. Not surprisingly, mammography is a fertile field for medical-legal conflict, and radiologists are acutely aware that errors can result in a malpractice lawsuit. Even the best radiologists will inaccurately read a mammogram in 2 to 3% of the cases, while some series show that other doctors incorrectly read the images in 20% or more. The aim is to recommend a biopsy on the women who will prove to have a tumor, and not to recommend a biopsy for women with benign changes in the mammogram. The women who undergo a biopsy are said to be called back. In theory, it would be best to have a 4 or 5% callback rate, Orwig said. This is considered to be the optimal rate. But the norm, Orwig said, is about 10 to 11%. This higher callback rate results in a larger number of women with benign changes who undergo further evaluation and biopsy. There is a trade-off here, causing emotional distress in women with benign changes versus the need to capture a number of breast cancers that otherwise would be missed. In Orwig's group of 11 radiologists, he falls in the callback rate of 10 to 11%, the norm. But one colleague has a 15 to 16% callback rate. Many of the women he calls back end up having benign biopsies. He was sued, Orwig told me. Years ago, he missed a breast cancer. This experience caused him to become more aggressive, as Orwig put it, in assessing mammograms and calling more women back for further studies and biopsies.